We have expanded, and that's a result of the Telegraph investing in people and products. But I think it's also testament to the growth of newsletters as a product. And I think that's not just at the Telegraph, but kind of on a global level at publishers across the board.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Media Voices. We are the B2B media organization that takes a look at everything to do with the business of media, whether that be subscriptions, advertising, your relationship with an audience, absolutely everything. I'm Chris.
I love the fact you just called us an organization.
You're right.
Quite a level of organization.
Yeah, we're the B2B disorganization that takes a look at all that stuff. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
And I'm Esther Thorpe.
You are.
Peter was on holiday this week, hence why I very nearly segued into his intro. And that clip you just heard was from my interview with The Telegraph's Myra Bonheim, head of newsletters, and David Alexander, deputy head of newsletters. So we talked about why The Telegraph and others are prioritising their newsletter portfolio, how newsletters can be used at different stages of the subscriber funnel, and what they've learned from a community-focused approach to their politics newsletter.
See, that's interesting. That's a really nice segue into our first item on the agenda today. The Atlantic has had quite a... well, successful year.
The headline is that last week they surpassed 1 million subscriptions. That's great. But we know it was a couple of years ago, Nick Thompson was saying that their new CEO, Nick Thompson, was saying that they're less focused on the number of people that got subscribing and they were actually really focused on the revenue per user. And there's been a huge turnaround there as well. So 3 years ago, they had like a $20 million deficit. They laid off 17% of their newsroom. And now they're profitable. And that's due to an announcement they made last week. So, yeah, it seems to be all roses on the Atlantic side.
Well, I mean, normally we tend to start optimistic at the top of the news roundup. And then as we go, we sort of like talk ourselves out of it. We sand away our own optimism.
Yeah, but Peter's not here this week. So can this be like an optimistic week?
The breakdown of subscriptions is really interesting. And we're going to try and pick out a couple of lessons from this for other publishers, if we can. I always feel a little bit disingenuous trying to do it in a lot of cases because each outlet is so, or rather all the successful outlets are so distinct in some way that's kind of what their success is predicated on, that finding lessons is obviously really, really difficult. But for The Atlantic, yeah, like you mentioned, 1 million subscribers is profitable. 56% of the subscriptions are digital and 44% are still print and digital. So I feel like an early lesson we can pull out.
That's a high level of print. I was quite surprised
you know
at
what?
That.
I also didn't expect that. I would have assumed it was at most a third print. Now, I suppose it might be because we're in the UK. The Atlantic, typically its print is based in the US. I don't know how many coffee tables it lands on.
Is the equivalent in the UK The Economist, where it's that kind of... I mean, I know The Economist is a weekly magazine, but it's very much premium, magazine-y. Like, it's news, but it's not newspapers. It's a news magazine, I suppose. And the Atlantic has always been a little bit more down that line than perhaps consumer magazines. And
but I suppose in terms of its USP, it's somewhere between something like The Week, The Economist, and potentially even something like, I don't know, The New Yorker. And it does include a lot of like deep, in-depth articles. And in fact, it sounds like that is what they are ascribing a lot of their success to, is, you know, this idea that they're doing a lot of really deep dive articles on topics that are of paramount importance to their audiences. And that is what they think is, you know, responsible for getting so many people to sign up. They specifically cite the pandemic as something that they built effectively a huge content strategy around.
The thing I loved about this is when they were in trouble a couple of years ago, Lauren Powell Jobs brought Nick Thompson in, was like, sort out the profitability issue. And he basically said that his core thing was to look at how much readers will be willing to pay for a subscription. And they've raised the subscription from around $50 a year to $80 a year, which is that's still pretty reasonable price.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it is. It's not quite the old Playboy where you'd get like 12 a year for $12. It's not quite that.
It is a little bit like that. And I suppose it's that he put some fantastic quotes in the notes that he sent around. And he said, the key to continued success is to be constructively dissatisfied with the present. So he's saying, well, we all believe very strongly that our 1 million subscriptions is just the foundation of future excellence. profitability is perilous in the media industry, and we're going to continue to be highly disciplined in how we run our operations. And I think that ties in. I know we've spoken before about some of the organizations seeing success, and you and Peter quite rightly pointed out that they were all small ones. But it is that discipline when you're a small outlet that you have to have in running your operations that I think if you're a bigger publisher that you're starting to apply, is going to pay off. And you know, you can see that in the figures that they've done, that revenue rose 10% last year to nearly $100 million. And two-thirds of that are now coming from subscriptions, which is up from half in 2021.
And we, obviously Peter's not here, but we would be remiss not to point out that subscriptions are a relatively stable source of revenue. You know, they are not the be-all and end-all, they're not a silver bullet, but if you do have people within your ecosystem paying, that is a very strong basis for a media business. What I thought was really interesting is, you know, they're talking about, we're going to be highly disciplined in how we run our operations. Potentially that is, you know, laying the groundwork for cutting somewhere, but it also could just be related to a deep examination of what sort of we're going to be using the word content forever, aren't we?
Yeah.
Looking at the sort of content that really matters to an audience and that paying audience. And it tied in really nicely with something that we included in the newsletter last week, which was Jacob Donnelly's piece about content audits and how, as painful as it might be, actually looking back at your, you know, regular series, looking back at what you run on a daily, weekly basis and going, that actually is not attracting enough subscribers, even though we love it internally and it actually has a really, like, it's laudable to do. That's going to be incredibly vital. Don't just do something because you've always done it.
Yeah, I mean, there's balance to that, isn't there? Mm. And you don't want to sort of be just completely be a slave to things that will make people subscribe because I'm sure it was DC Thompson talking about this in their, they did some interviews with us for the Future Briefing local news special. And they said the thing about their local news audience, and it's where the example plays out, is that often people will enjoy some of the features and some of the sort of less directly relevant things rather than always necessarily being like, this, everything you write has to have ROI. Sometimes it can be nice just to have pleasant, delightful, surprising things to keep you informed.
How on earth do you pour through all that data and go, this didn't directly contribute to subscription revenue, but it was a vital part in that. We just can't really attribute it. How do you even do that?
Well, I think part of it, and it's in the, they do say it, but it's kind of, they almost gloss over it a little bit, is that it's not about necessarily refining their content strategy in terms of what they're covering. They say, if we're going to cover something, we're going to cover it really deeply. So like their pandemic coverage was really, really deep. And I found some fascinating Atlantic pieces that, you know, because it's an Atlantic piece, that if you find the headline interesting, they're going to go deep.
Yeah.
And you're going to come away from it thinking, that was a really good read. You're not going to ever click on an Atlantic piece and be dissatisfied with it.
No. I was thinking about this, and it seems like such a no-brainer. You pay for the stuff that you can't find anywhere else that actually delivers some value. If I think about Atlantic pieces, there's a little switch that flicks in my mind and I go, that's going to be really good. Like you said, if I like the headline, I'm going to like this long read. And I was trying to think about how you could marry something like the Atlantic strategy here of doing really in-depth, lengthy examinations of topics with something like delayed gratification, which is kind of the same, but, you know, after the fact, or positive news, which, you know, people are paying for that kind of constructive journalism as well. So there has to be a sweet spot for these subscription models where you go, well, actually people are paying for this. It costs a shitload of money to create this, but ultimately that's what delivers value back to the subscribers. But getting in, like, buy-in to do that, if you don't already have a reputation for doing those in-depth pieces, must be so difficult. Like, and you can't, I can't see the mail suddenly turning around. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, this thing about their Mail Plus thing is that I'm sure the content they produce on Mail Plus is good, but they don't have that reputation for everything.
No.
And I think it is the same with The Economist here, is that if you click on an Economist piece, you know you're getting a good read.
Mm.
I'm trying to think of other examples now.
New Yorker does a lot of really good stuff
New Yorker
as well. Like, I'm trying to think of who published The Voyeur's Motel, which is always the one I go to, by Gay Talese, even though that, I think that turned out to be like absolute bollocks. Who was that?
Do you know, I wonder if there's a bit of a virtuous circle that ends up for me here. And this is where we really just need Peter to come back from holiday, is where if you're writing and you've still got that print project and you've got to keep the content really, really tight and good for that print project, that it does feed into that digital strategy. You can't just go down the deep content, the cheap content route, because you've always got to keep that sort of feature, magazine feature style. There was a really, really interesting little note in this that I want to get onto before we we'd talk about AI. So there was, the Wall Street Journal piece said that they are actually seeing some success with Apple News Plus, which, if you're not familiar with it, is Apple News Plus is a £12.99 British pounds a month after a free trial, and it gives you access to a number of, I'm going to quote, premium publications. basically, a lot of paywall content that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily pay separately to. It's always, they want it to be the Spotify of news.
Yeah, they want to be the kind of the Prime Video. It's got all the other like channels. Yeah, beginning, exactly.
Yeah. And actually, so The Atlantic has about 100,000 users who read The Atlantic content through Apple News Plus. They've said the magazine through Apple News Plus. And Nick Thompson said that The Atlantic apparently gets roughly the same amount of revenue from people Apple counts as an Atlantic subscriber as it gets per direct subscriber. Now, that's... my understanding of Apple's model there is that it distributes the revenue it gets from people based on how much time you spend, how much time they spend reading those publications. So that implies to me that people who are reading The Atlantic through Apple News are spending a lot of time with Atlantic content.
I think you're exactly right about that. Like, you need to have something that is worthy of spending time with to get C value from Apple. I wonder what that does in turn to Apple's news ecosystem. Does that sort of imply that you are getting, you know, you quote unquote premium before? Does that lead to a greater proportion of quote unquote premium publications on the platform? There could not be more plosives in that sentence. It's just endless P's.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the occasions it's actually a shame Apple is so cagey about anything News Plus, because it would be so interesting to dive really deep into how that looks as a product 3 or 4 years on, given that there was a lot of criticism, you know, myself included, when it first launched, and it took a long time to get going. But if they're seeing that kind of revenue, like that, the matching subscriber revenue, either The Atlantic are not charging enough, or those Apple users are really, really valuable.
So here comes another P word. What is the priority? How high up their priority list is appearing in Apple News now? Because it used to be an endless topic of conversation on this podcast. We used to talk about it week in, week out, or at least once a month. And yet now I feel like we barely talk about it unless it's a very specific sort of like use case.
It's because nobody ever talks about it. Nobody shares anything. I think this approach that Nick Thompson's got is the right one, is to say how much do we get per... You know, they are so focused on... And I hate this as an acronym, but ARPU.
ARPU, yeah.
Average revenue per user. They're so focused on ARPU. And if that is good for your Apple News Plus relationship, then great. You're probably in the right place. You're probably the right kind of publisher to be doing that. If you're not, and you're losing out, or you know, you're not doing particularly well, or your content isn't resonating, then it's not going to be the right place for everybody. But I think, again, The Atlantic probably sits in that sweet spot of what Apple wants as content on there.
Well, you mentioned virtuous circles before, and I feel like that is the textbook definition of that in terms of the media industry. You're doing deep dive content. You're doing stuff that actually you know matters to your audience. Mm. And it just so happens to align with what Apple wants. They boost one another. So, yeah, I can absolutely see that. But it also, I think, ties into what the kind of the first lesson that I feel we can take away from this, which is that if you have a strong enough brand and you have a reputation, as we said before, for doing this kind of content, you can, as Nick Thompson said, be a lot stricter about your paywall. You can experiment with that. You can also experiment with pricing. There is a lot of price flexibility that you can do. And obviously this is kind of over the last year. So
yeah, and I think it's knowing what your USP is, and if you are publishing something that no other publishers are, you can put your prices up and you can push that.
We keep there are too many P's. Like every sentence has about like 5 P words in it.
I know. I'm sorry. I've got my filter.
Okay, well, here's another lesson which has a ton of P's in it. If even a profitable media company says profitability is perilous, then it must be incredibly difficult for everybody else, because they're in a position where they should be shouting about this from the rooftops. They should be going, we are going to invest, we're going to be reinvesting in all this kind of good stuff. Instead, they're saying, we are in a position where we need to be aware that this is not a guarantee of success in the long term or even the midterm. They're like, even somewhere as like storied and successful now as The Atlantic is saying, we're just going to keep an eye on it. This is great. I'm not going to check the bank balance because, you know, one day it's just going to fall away. We're just going to keep being cautious.
Yeah, I think that something that ties into that, and we've seen this with Future in the UK, is that if you are in a bit of a sticky situation like this, the difference that a focused leader with a vision can make I think Nick Thompson came over from Wired initially, and he's obviously had this purview where he's got to get this company's profitability. He's got a couple of ways he's going to do it, and he's just been very, very focused on that, and they've achieved that. With Zillow did a huge turnaround on Future in the UK. They were really poor performers back in 2014, and within 8 years, she'd completely turned the company around. And I think it just goes to show you can still have the media. If you have strong media leadership, you can get some real star power in really helping navigate choppy waters.
here's how much of a time capsule this podcast is now. People can go back and listen to the episode we did with Nick Thompson when he was still at Wired, talking about their paywall strategy. Like, and they can sort of, I suppose, see how that then impacts the thinking at The Atlantic. We should be charging a lot for this. This is basically like the Library of Alexandria.
Do you think Nick Thompson can work for us?
Yeah, I'm sure he would, pro bono.
This week I spoke to The Telegraph's Myra Bonheim, Head of Newsletters, and David Alexander, Deputy Head of Newsletters. So we talked about how newsletters can work to support publishers' business models and build communities. But first, I asked them both how they came to work on The Telegraph's rapidly growing newsletter team.
We have expanded, and that's a result of The Telegraph investing in people and products. But I think it's also testament to the growth of newsletters as a product. And I think that's not just at The Telegraph, but kind of on a global level, at publishers across the board, it seems that people are investing more in newsletters, which is brilliant to see.
And where were you both working before you came here?
Well, I was working at the Metro, where I did some kind of newsletter bits, like the What's On in London newsletter, which is the kind of big one there, and football newsletters. And that's where I first got into newsletters, really.
And I studied journalism. My first job was in journalism, but I then moved into a more commercial setting for a few years and kind of made my way back to The Telegraph after that. And I think that's something that I'm never sure whether I should bring that up or not, because in an editorial setting, that's not always seen as a positive, but actually it does come with a lot of knowledge and a different mindset that I think is actually quite helpful for newsletters, especially because it's such a bridge role and you have to work with marketing, design, and a whole lot of different editorial desks. And you actually have to build relationships as much as you have to have editorial skills. And I also think it doesn't hurt in a newsletter setting, even in an editorial setting, to be thinking more about the reader and the reader's reaction to what you're putting out, how to convert the reader into a consistent paying subscriber.
I'll definitely touch on that later. I suppose it's quite interesting that I feel like in a lot of publishers, the newsletter is just kind of left to the editorial team. And it's just interesting to hear you talk about actually needing to maybe connect up some of those different departments in order to make it a success.
Definitely. And I think, not specifically talking about The Telegraph here, but often a newsletter in some settings editorially is kind of seen as an afterthought that someone, an intern, chucks together, and it's not the kind of real job. But actually, more and more, newsletters are the shop window and the first experience that a reader has of a publication. So their importance is huge.
So what does The Telegraph's newsletter portfolio look like now? And I suppose as part of that, what did it look like when you joined? Like, what have you done to it?
So we have 35 newsletters in the portfolio currently.
Good grief.
But that is constantly under review. So we're constantly assessing performance in terms of the growth numbers, but engagement, the open and click rates, and what people are reading when they click through. And so we have just this year, we've already cut two of our newsletters, which were underperforming. One of them we completely cut because the niche was just too small, and one of them we merged into another newsletter. So we are consistently doing that, as well as looking for new niches to grow. We also have newsletters that fulfill different goals. So some of them might be specifically aimed at retaining our existing subscribers. Some might specifically be aimed at providing a shop window to registrants who aren't sure yet and are dipping their toes. And they do different things and we assess them using different metrics. We also do pop-ups for events and newsletter series.
Those newsletters that are sort of shop fronts, people have to be registered with the Telegraph website in order to receive those.
Yes. So we have some newsletters that are open to read for anyone, but you do have to become a registrant of the Telegraph to read them. But once you are registered, we provide, to be honest, incredible content that can be read for free. So, for example, our dispatcher's newsletter is sent twice a week, and it includes correspondence from reporters that are on the ground in conflict situations, basically doing a dispatch from the front line in many cases. So Ukraine, Gaza, providing genuinely incredible content that's exclusive to that newsletter and that you can't find anywhere else. And I think that that's just one example of a newsletter that kind of shows a reader who might not be sure about subscribing to the Telegraph yet, just the level of incredible content that we produce.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because I know a lot of publishers hit that thing where especially if they've got a paywall, you don't want to just give like a list of links, because even a registered user will just keep hitting that paywall. So it's that idea of like giving them a bit of a sample of the journalism without necessarily just constantly saying, right, you need to register.
Definitely. I mean, we do also have our subscriber exclusive newsletters that provide exclusive columns that can only be found there for the readers. So, for example, our very popular royal appointment newsletter includes kind of behind the scenes royal family content. We have a very popular newsletter which is penned by Matt, our cartoonist, and it provides behind the scenes insight into his thoughts and, well, what he was doing when he was sketching his kind of quite world famous cartoons. So that's, to be honest, the Matt cartoon newsletter is probably one of our most popular in the whole portfolio.
I bet he's been busy the last couple of weeks. And for those subscriber newsletters, how do you go about marketing them? Because again, you've got that thing that you don't want to give it away for free, but you do want to kind of encourage people to maybe subscribe as a benefit of that.
We do initiatives such as during the coronation last year for the royal, just using the royal appointment newsletter as an example, we did a free trial for registrants. So you didn't need to be a subscriber to read it during. We did a special edition daily send over that time. Journalists from all around the newsroom contributed amazing segments for that. For example, food, the ancient traditions of the coronation, various bits and pieces of royal content that you couldn't find anywhere else. And our registrants were able to sign up and receive a free trial for the duration of that. And at the end of it, we did convert quite a substantial number of those to becoming follow-on subscribers as a result.
How do you find that with the journalists in the newsroom? Do you find that they're happy to have maybe some more exclusive content in the newsletters, or are they still sort of hoping it'll reach a wider audience?
Yeah, so we have a daily politics newsletter which comes from Westminster and Whitehall. It's full of exclusive gossip. It's really characterful and it's really thorough. There's loads to it and it's free for registrants. And it also has these kind of fantastic reader-led interviews, which might come on to later. But yeah, the person who writes that, Dominic Penner, really puts a substantial portion of his day into doing it. And it's exclusive to the newsletter and it's for registrants. And he absolutely loves doing it. He's mad keen on it. And I think he likes, and we're doing all kind of fun things to support him in it. Like we've got a little mug with a cartoon version of him coming out soon. And I think one of the things he likes about it is that it's going to a wider constituency than just normal Telegraph subscribers. It's an opportunity to show off to the wider world how good our political journalism is. And at the same time, because it's in a newsletter rather than on the site, I think it can be that extra little bit more playful and whimsical and fun, while also being serious when it needs to be. And so, yeah, I just think it's a great place to do something a bit different for a slightly broader audience. And to give, I think what it gives journalists is an opportunity to show a bit more of themselves than they would normally do in the course of their normal work. And so in my experience, they've all been kind of really up for it and they don't view it as a secondary part of their day at all.
And I think in the case of the politics newsletter and Dominic Penner, he can see the popularity because of the number of reader emails he gets. The response is absolutely massive. If he asks a question in that newsletter, he'll receive you know, hundreds or even thousands of responses to that. So we can see that the engagement is there and people are truly building a relationship with him as a journalist.
Do you find that's something that happens much more with that person-led newsletter rather than maybe just an anonymous brand-led newsletter, is that people feel they can just email back rather than if it's just something from the Telegraph?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, with the politics one, every month Dom does an interview with a politician and he asks them questions that he takes from the newsletter readers, and they email their questions in, hundreds or thousands of questions, often begun like, hi Dominic, or dear Dominic, or whatever, you know, personally addressed to him. He puts them to the politician, and then often the answers from those questions, which come from the readers, will like generate news lines and become stories and appear in print and everything. And so his personality like facilitates this great community, really, which ends up with user-generated journalism. And I think he's like the connective tissue, weird way of putting it, but he is, you know. I don't think there would be the same response if it was just an anonymous call out for questions from readers.
You should get that on a t-shirt for him. I'm connective tissue.
yeah. When we get the mug Mark II, we'll put that on. We're doing this live event in a few weeks, a live version of these interviews, because they've been such a success. And we're doing it with Nigel Farage, and Camilla Tomlin is going to be there chatting to Farage, but Dom will be there too, giving an introduction. And I think it's just a great opportunity for our readers to like physically meet this guy who they, you know, kind of talk to every day. I think newsletters are, because especially the daily ones, readers spend so much time with them, they should almost be like friends you want to hang out with. You know, you're giving people a lot of stuff and you're asking them to commit a lot of time to you. And so you should want to enjoy their company. You know, there shouldn't be a chore. There shouldn't be homework. They should be interesting. And yeah, like a conversation with a friend that is not boring or teacherly, but is fun and insightful and all the best things that all the best friends are. So yeah, I think that's the benefit of putting a journalist front and center of a newsletter, I think.
It's kind of what social media used to be. You used to like follow people that were fun and it's just all...
yeah, those are the days.
I'm really interested in that live event. So that's specifically tied to the newsletter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something like anybody can attend, or is it ticketed, or is it just for subscribers?
Yeah, so basically subscribers can attend it, but our newsletter readers who were subscribers got first dibs on the in-person tickets.
And they can also submit questions directly to the by responding to the newsletter, they can submit questions for Nigel Farage.
Yeah, absolutely. And then subscribers in general will be able to sign up to watch the event online. But really, the newsletter is front and center. You know, it's the newsletter readers got first dibs. It's the newsletter readers who are sending in the questions.
Yeah, it's just really interesting, given how much political stuff the Telegraph covers, that it's the newsletter that spawned that event in a way, rather than maybe it coming from sort of the wider brand.
I think the success of these reader-led interviews, which are hosted exclusively in the newsletter every month, it deserves a live event of this scale because the engagement has been so high. And so I agree, it almost feels a bit surreal to see like politics newsletter and all this stuff for such a big event. But I actually think it's testament to how successful that newsletter has been and what a great community has grown up around it. So in that sense, it's not that odd, I think.
So is that approach of building that community around a one journalist or one newsletter, is that something you would replicate across the other, I think you said 38? Is there slightly different purposes there?
I think it depends on the newsletter. It's definitely something, I think fostering community is something that we want to do across the board, but some of the newsletters do have different purposes, and some of them are, you know, we have newsletters that are algorithm-led and are simply aimed at showcasing the most popular content or the content that the reader is most likely to interact with. And that those are just aimed at kind of providing a service by curating content for the reader and getting them to the site. So it really depends on what the purpose of that specific newsletter is.
You mentioned about algorithmically generated newsletters. Which ones are those? And are you happy to talk a bit about how those work?
So we do have a small selection of newsletters which are I wouldn't call them newsletters in the traditional sense, because they don't include exclusive written content in them, but rather they're a selection of articles which are pulled based on the reader's interests. And they perform really well in terms of reader interaction, as you would imagine that they would. I wouldn't say that we'd want to make all of our newsletters like that, but they provide a service for some readers who simply want to receive a no-nonsense list of the top articles that are relevant to them, say, every morning, for example.
So if you sign up as a subscriber to the Telegraph website, I presume you sort of get to choose which of those newsletters you subscribe to.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you find there's a correlation between people who subscribe and, I suppose, open and read quite a few of those and retention?
We do, actually. We do have one stat, which is that if people become a subscriber to the Telegraph after clicking on a link in a newsletter, they're 50% more likely to still be a subscriber a year later.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we definitely do see that being engaged with newsletters and or subscribing on the basis of a newsletter, it really creates a high quality reader who is likely to remain engaged with the Telegraph long term.
That's really interesting, because that makes them quite a high marketing channel as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously we work in conjunction with marketing. But I think I always like to think of it as using our excellent journalism as kind of marketing that speaks for itself, you know, as a shop window, really. So people get a taste of what they can receive more of if they subscribe to the Telegraph when they sign up to these newsletters. And in a way, that's the best marketing of all.
Definitely. I don't think people are subscribing to the Telegraph because of a marketing offer message. In almost all cases, it's because they've just read incredible journalism and they want to subscribe on the basis of that.
Is there anything else you've learned about that sort of more community-focused approach with email that maybe could work elsewhere?
Well, I think it works well for community because the barrier to entry for readers is quite low. You know, to be part of the community, there's not a huge amount they have to do. When they put their email in, we come to them, you know, like we're emailing directly into their inbox. They don't have to go looking for us. We'll be there. And in return, for them to participate in the community, all they have to do is reply to the email. You know, it's dead easy. And so I think that means that the onus is then on us to do something interesting with their comments and show that it's just like a circular relationship. And we do that, to be fair. We have this letters to the editor newsletter where our kind of fantastic letters editor collates readers' comments on both like the harder big news stories of the week and all kinds of random topics that have come from what readers are talking about. I mean, so random you won't believe, like associations of people protecting frogs around the UK or, you know, hotels for dogs. You know, it's totally off the wall and it's brilliant because it all comes from the readers. You know, I don't think an algorithm could generate whatever that is, you know. And it shows that readers' contributions mean something to us. They're not just going into our spam, you know? And yeah, I think increasingly, as much as readers like receiving content from on high, they like getting in touch with other readers and feeling that they're communicating with like-minded people and that there are people like them in the country or in the world. And yeah, newsletters are a great place to host that, I think.
I suppose there's a final question. Email is not a new form of communication. It's one of the oldest sort of forms of digital communication. Why are publishers now suddenly prioritizing them and suddenly seeing them as important?
I think there are quite a few reasons for that. One of them has to do with, we touched on social briefly earlier, and the fact that social platforms, a lot of them are turning away from news or turning off the taps to traffic. And ownership of the platform and list is increasingly important. You're not at the mercy of an external company's algorithms. You also have access to information about what the readers are engaging with and interested in, which can help you improve the articles and the content that you produce, which again is something that's becoming harder to glean from external platforms. It's push rather than pull media, so you're not waiting for someone to come to you, but you are pushing something out to them. And even if someone hadn't planned to engage with your publication that day, if you produce a subject line that's interesting enough, you can create that interaction. It's a curated shop window. It says who we are. And it's also finite and curated in a kind of infinite scroll world. you can read something that feels like it's created by a real person, and you can finish it, and you can feel that you have kind of gained all of the necessary knowledge on that topic that you're interested in. And yeah, finally, I think they just really do promote that trust and relationship, build that habit. And we see that with journalists and influencers who are turning to Substack a lot of the time now instead of traditional publications.
And we know that after this episode and that interview in particular, you'll probably be burnt out on newsletters, but please, we beg you, go to voices.media and sign up to our own. It goes out every single day of the working week. It contains the top 4 most important stories that you need to know. And again, in lieu of Peter, it's the sort of story that you can take into a break room, you can take to your boss, regurgitate and say, this will make us successful. This will make you look smart. So you can do that by going to voices.media. While there, sign up to our community as well, where we talk about this on the forums all the time.
And if you still haven't had enough of a newsletter, entries are now open for the Publisher Newsletter Rewards for a couple more weeks. If you've got a potentially award-winning publisher newsletter or newsletter strategy, do tell us about it. You can enter for free at publishernewsletters.com.
So for now, thank you so much for listening. It has been a pleasure as always. We'll be back next week with another fantastic guest. But for now, thank you so much. Have a great week.